welcome to the stage, Alex and Ken June.
Thanks so much.
Welcome, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Dustin, for the honor.
Beautiful. Having been described as a banger, I think everything's going to be downhill from there. So just want to warn everyone.
The expectations are high, so.
Yeah. I'm coming from the suburbs. So
okay,
I don't usually
from
get
the
called
burbs.
A banger much.
Okay. And you are I'm just very glad for you that you're here because I know you also have a young family. So thank you so much for making the time and joining us.
Now, thanks for having me again.
Perfect.
Okay. So usually we start with like, what's your story and how did it all start? But I think that will all unravel itself. And so I actually want to start with something else and let's just get to the heart of the matter, which is when it comes to foundation models and data, what do people get wrong?
Well, it's such a rapidly evolving space that the kinds of things people get wrong changes every day, just like the models do. I think when we started the kind of hype cycle around ChatGPT, the thing that people got wrong with is kind of embedded in the reason we like the term foundation model at Stanford and Snorkel, which is that it's a foundation to build on top of, not just generative use cases, but often what we call analytical or predictive workloads. And we're very, you know, we're all in on that and have been for many years. But that it doesn't necessarily take care of all the house building on top. And so when we kind of started the hype cycle, there was a lot of questions of, you know, let's start with the obvious one is data labeling and data development needed? Are data scientists needed? Are humans needed? These are some of the astute questions posed by people who had been learning their AI, or, you know, getting their AI chops in the Bitcoin mines 6 months ago, and we're now AI thought leaders. Too close to home? funny thing actually, in academia, if you were doing Bitcoin and then you actually can trade in your diploma and you become an AI expert, uh-huh. thought leader. That's what happened right around wow. ChatGPT, in case anyone was wondering how that all went down. But look, I mean, I think one thing that we learned was that, I think that we're learning still, is that, you know, a lot of us kind of overestimate how difficult it is to make plausible sounding unstructured data streams, like natural language utterances, images, et cetera. I wouldn't say that's like a consensus take, but I think even those of us who have been doing AI for a very long time, we're absolutely blown away by the coherence of large language models and multimodal foundation models. And so, I was being a little unfair, and it's kind of natural to extrapolate and say, hey, maybe everything is solved. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of that. And the bet that we've taken, commercial, academic, and that, you know, I would say largely has borne very true and is kind of now, you know, pretty commonly accepted in the market, is that, you know, these models will work out of the box for some things. But just like an undergrad usually needs some onboarding and training before they become an underwriter or an oncologist or, you know, a trade surveillance expert at a bank, these foundation models also need some house building on top. They need some tuning. So I think that was kind of, you know, maybe misconception number one is that these are magic. I could talk all day. I'm going to cut myself off. But I'll say one thing that's interesting is that we've been bad for decades at predicting what AI will be good or bad at. And it's often flipped from what humans are good and bad at. So an anecdote that I love, there's many of you know about, you know, image and computer vision, maybe you probably work on startups or on research projects in that space. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. There are multiple academic conferences. That was an entire field of computer vision, how we see and perceive the world in the 80s was assigned as a summer internship research project. Because people thought that, well, seeing is easy for us, just like grasping, that's robotics. probably easy for computers and, like, you know, chess and, you know, complex math, that's going to be really tough for them. Well, it was completely flipped. So I think we've actually seen some of those misconceptions in a different set happen at the start of the ChatGPT hype cycle. I think a great example of that is software copilot tools. Software engineers, at least last time I checked, our burn rate are very highly comped and very highly sought after, and it's a very challenging skill. So it's natural to assume that, you know, if you could do that, then you can kind of do anything, right? Downhill from there. But if you think about it from kind of AI first principles, there's a ton of code on the internet. code is a fairly universal language, so the code on the internet is fairly directly transferable to, you know, most settings where code is used. And the method in which AI is deployed is you know, very buffered from you know, or there's a high failure tolerance because it's usually a co-pilot. There's a very smart human in the loop to kind of check what the AI suggests. There are, you know, compiler checks and unit tests and all kinds of buffers. So it's actually, if you think about it from that perspective, kind of an easy task. And it's not surprising that that is, you know, some of the application domain where AI has hit, you know, real material run rates in terms of, you know, products and businesses the soonest. But I think we kind of took, you know, think like we took all the, you know, plausible sounding natural language. We took things like automation or partial automation of software engineering and extrapolated very naturally from that, but incorrectly, that these models would just kind of work out of the box. So I think that was kind of thing number one. And thing number two, which is where I start shamelessly shilling the snorkel wares. I guess I alliterate when I get tired. I don't know why that's happening. But is that, you know, how are we actually going to build these models? Was it going to, you know, okay, we accept that there's some work to be done in terms of actually getting them to work. Is it just going to be prompt engineering? Is it going to, you know, what is the tool set going to be? You know, I'll use another kind of, you know, human metaphor, even though those can be misleading, but, you know, think about what you would need to do to get an undergrad to become an underwriter or a satellite expert or whatever specialist you're looking to build. You generally don't approach that via brain surgery. You generally do it by feeding a curriculum of curated data to that person. Interestingly enough, AI, you know, certainly when we started the Snorkel project like about a decade ago, was all about the brain surgery. Many of you who were data scientists, you know, back then, you know, just like myself, you know, you learned or even taught those courses where it was, you know, building the models and the algorithms from scratch. Now we're a little bit more, you know, in the human domain where you don't, you know, adapt or improve a 70 or 700 billion parameter model by kind of tweaking parameters. You do it by adjusting what data you feed in, whether to the prompt or, you know, in other words, the context, to pre-training, fine-tuning, alignment. So I think kind of misconception number two is that a lot of the old tools and the boring things like data would kind of be less important when in fact they became more important because you actually don't have many other ports by which to program LLMs these days. I'm going to cut myself off there. I could go on and on, but that was, I think, longer than I was supposed to go for question number one.
It's so true. I really resonate with the data point. And your point about AI being better at things than humans, but worse at things than humans are. Blah. Humans are good at things AI is bad at. It's funny, we have like millions of years of evolution for motor control, and like that's not on the internet. So,
exactly. Okay. Yeah.
When you first started Snorkel, it was an open source project. I imagine you were not planning to sell to Apple and Google. What was it at the beginning? And then how did you eventually sell to enterprises?
Yeah, so I actually also correct that. And I hope I'll see if you know half of the folks kind of quietly filter out because we are not actually selling to Apple and Google. We worked with them and we have deployed technology to them. We sell, I would think maybe, you know, I'd say a tier, well, be politic or a different segment of the market. So, for example, we work with 7 of the top 10 U.S. banks. We work across somewhere like 10 to 12 different verticals, so telecom, pharma. Think about anywhere where there's, you know, I mean, go by the simple heuristics I was just sharing.
Okay, these are still large
yes,
companies.
They're very large companies, so, yeah. But they're very different than selling to an Apple or a Google.
Fair.
I mean, it's actually, I mean, happy to talk about that. Those companies are wonderful research partners. They're wonderful contributors and consumers of open source. They'll consume, you know, data through the back door. They generally won't buy platforms. Is at least, you know,
they build their own.
Yeah, I mean, they don't even have good procurement processes for doing that. And there's also a little bit of a cultural hubris there.
Yeah.
But I mean, some people have sold in, so I don't generalize from my experiences. But I think it's actually interesting that a lot of startups have come out of the route that we came, which is academia, largely either directly by collaboration or indirectly via funding, having been influenced by a small number of tech companies that they were probably going to never sell to. Mm. And even if they could, would not scale as a, you know, an ICP.
So what changed about the product? Like what had to change when you started selling to these larger companies?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, these companies, you know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different things that change both in the product and in the go-to-market motion to support the product. And that doesn't just mean, you know, salespeople in suits. You need very smart salespeople to navigate these large, you know, political jungle gyms. But it also means, you know, data scientists, like probably many of the folks here, who help guide enterprises through evaluations before a sale, and then help support and train and teach afterwards. So there's a lot of process around it. You know, keep in mind the average enterprise sales cycle, best in class, is, you know, 9 to 10 months for at least that kind of like Fortune 500 tier. So there's a lot of patience and skill and capital required to tackle these places, at least from a sales-led approach. You know.
So there are a lot of founders in the audience, many of whom are probably interested in selling to enterprises. I assume that's why you're here. In terms of the go-to-market motion, what was it like before, and how did you have to change your go-to-market motion in order to really support this kind of like longer sales cycle and the like heavier people load?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll note that, you know, that I have the privilege of working with people on the team who know far more than I do about the go-to-market motion. Actually, I had a chance about 2 weeks ago through a Lightspeed event to pitch to Jensen at NVIDIA. And we, you know, of course, pitched him on the technical stuff, but then we talked a little bit about go-to-market. And, you know, dig at me when I was walking off was, I never thought I'd hear a professor talking about enterprise go-to-market, which is very fair, right? So let's just be aware of who we're listening to here. But it is something that, honestly, even for those folks who are kind of on the research side here, if there are any, it's a mode that we were in on the research side of. We didn't just kind of put up a fancy algorithm or theory and put the paper up and then just kind of walk away. We were kind of like the sales-led equivalent and are on the research side of. We would pick a cohort of design partners, call them. These are like the customers. They were like, you know, doctors or scientists or journalists or something, you know, something nonprofit, but back in the academic days and still in that side. But we would, you know, go from first mile of what are you actually trying to accomplish? What are your baseline methods? How are you thinking about success? To last mile delivery. And only then would we actually kind of, you know, publish papers. So it was a process that we had just started with as the best way to actually learn about how to build systems that actually align with real value. So we were actually, as much as, you know, Jensen's joke was apt, it was actually something that was very material to just how we thought about building and researching systems. So, you know, carry that into the metaphor for enterprise. You know, a lot of people default to thinking about this kind of product-led growth motion where you, you know, for an enterprise, would just kind of throw something over the wall and hope for organic adoption. And that's a great motion when it works for you. But I think a lot of the learnings that we've, I think, are becoming more mainstream recently is like that's the exception rather than the norm. And it was in, you know, large part papered over by the kind of zero interest rate phenomenon that we just all, you know, suffered through. It was so difficult having cash thrown at you all the time. But that actually, it's not a default, and it only works sometimes. And it's great if it does. But a lot of, you know, most enterprise sales works by actually having a team of people, you know, Salesforce, that actually goes and, you know, tries to align what you're selling with what their objectives are. And that's actually really important, not just their objectives that they'll tell you at the innovation lab, but the objectives that someone with actual budget in a profit-making center, or if it's not a for-profit enterprise, some, you know, the core of the business, not the innovation lab, actually cares about, aligning to that, setting up evaluations, going through legal paperwork and process. Then there's all kinds of, to your question about what needs to change in the product, there's all kinds of enterprise requirements. You know, if you're doing something with data and AI, like you know, again, Snorkel is a platform for labeling and developing data to tune and align models. You know, there's all kinds of you know, role-based access controls and auditing and governance requirements and data privacy if you're taking it off, or on-prem installation and management if you're going on-prem, and you know, all kinds of features like that
stuff
take a long time to build.
Takes a long time to build.
Yeah.
You've talked about how AI today is in the prototype stage, and it's not really production ready. How do we get to, and when do we get to production ready?
Yeah, so I think in general, we have there's some things that kind of just worked out of the box and are driving real value. And then there are a lot of things that are really in a demo stage. And I think this is especially true in the enterprise, where a lot of stuff is in the kind of, like, has to cross the chasm. I don't mean to restrict it only to enterprise, but I'll just note, since we were just talking about that, like, it's more than an anecdote. I'd say it's, like, happened nearly, like 92% of the Fortune 500 were or are using ChatGPT. Hmm. About 92% of the Fortune 500, I believe, you know, end of 23, built some kind of chatbot demo, pitched it all the way up to the CEO often, and now have to figure out how the hell they get that chatbot to actually work reliably in production without, like, you know, getting them involved in, like, AI personhood lawsuits, if you followed that, you know, that the airline that recently had their chatbot, you know, start giving free offers and stuff, things like that. So, you know, it's a big year, I think, for crossing that innovation lab demo to real production model chasm. And there's so many things. So the Snorkel focus is on the tuning and adaptation of models. So for us, for the part that we bite off, and you know, it's really about, you know, in many ways, I think a lot of the especially in the enterprise, and that's where most of my experience is, but I think this will extend out beyond that, is going from kind of a generalist to a specialist. So I think we, like, finally just got displaced off of this Alpaca eval leaderboard by some friends at another Stanford team using, like, a slightly different algorithm, but our same data. But either way, like, those winning models that we crafted the data for are, like, 7 billion parameter models, and they're beating on that leaderboard. Leaderboards are meaningless in a vacuum, but the point is just that on, like, for an objective that we had specified, in this case, winning this leaderboard, a 7 billion parameter model beats even the biggest, hottest model, you know, Claude 3 Opus that came out. Like, it's still below it in the leerboard. Yeah. So the point is, if you have a specialty task you need to do, this is just intuition. You know, you can usually, if you do it correctly, get a small specialist to beat a giant generalist.
Yeah.
Think intuition, like, it's great. I'm sure there are many consumer cases out there that I don't know about where you really need a model that can both, like, you know, recite or compose Klingon poetry and ace a coding interview and, like, whatever else. But, like, certainly in the enterprise, most use cases, you just need to do one thing reliably. In fact, you get in trouble for doing too many things. I was talking to an enterprise exec who was saying, like, we need to have less capabilities.
That's,
like,
really interesting.
We don't want someone, like, what was the other one? Like, the car dealership that had people were just, like, using it as basically a free ChatGPT portal.
Free ChatGPT.
like do coding co-pilots, and they were footing the bill for that. like you want to do fewer things. You want it to do those few things much more accurately, robustly, and cheaply. So a lot of what we work on is the data to tune smaller models. It's often also called distillation. So basically, take some big generalist that maybe gets 60, 70, 80% accuracy and tune it so it gets to be 99% accurate, and also usually shrink it down and make it smaller and cheaper. So I'll give an example. Top 10 US bank read out to the CIO recently on a big project they've been using Snorkelflow, our platform, for. They had been on a key subset of questions over these things called collateralized loan obligations, so these multi-hundred page documents, very domain specific, not out on the internet. They had an awesome demo, you know, GPT-4 plus unnamed RAG kind of, you know, data connector tool. And I'm not saying that to sound salacious, just because it doesn't really matter. It's just, the key was it wasn't tuned for their use case. They were getting about 25% accuracy. So by just tuning, actually, not just the LLM, but the LLM system, so tuning the model, tuning the RAG retrieval system, tuning the embeddings, in other words, not just tuning the model on how to kind of, you know, say things at the LLM level, but also how to find the right things in these very massive domain-specific documents, we were able to get to, I think we're about 93% right now in a couple of weeks. So what is this all about? It's really just, you know, you have domain-specific data, domain-specific objectives. You've just got to kind of tune not just the LLM, but the LLM system to work in those settings, just like you'd have to onboard, you know, a college student. And just like a college student, you can't just, I don't think, my oldest is 4, so I haven't lived this yet, but, like, I don't think you can just send your kid back to college for 12 more years and suddenly they come out and they're an underwriter. So, you know, again, this is all bounded by what's out there on the public internet. I'm fairly confident that, you know, GPT-5, 6, 7, unless all of the banks in the world decide to open source their data, are not going to, you know, suddenly work out of the box. They're going to need to be tuned and onboarded. So that's kind of one step. And then there's all kinds of other things that are outside of Snorkel, but security and, you know, reliability and auditability and governance. And, you know, there's a million and one things that, especially in big enterprises, have to be taken care of very, very meticulously.
Is 93% good enough?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Yeah. Okay. That's what I'd expect. Yeah. And I can corroborate that 7B models can be better than Claude 3.
Although it's interesting, actually, accuracy numbers, this is kind of set orthogonal to Snorkel, but accuracy numbers are kind of meaningless unless you know how they're being deployed.
Exactly, so like, the task.
You know, I could take a 60% model, but if it's 100% calibrated, meaning it knows perfectly when it is
when
wrong
it doesn't
and right,
know. Yeah.
I could deploy that right away. Totally. I could take a 98% model that's completely uncalibrated, meaning I have no idea about the 2% error mode, and in some settings, I could never deploy that. So the answer is kind of yes and no, depending on what they want to do with it, what they're still working out.
But. Yeah, I actually think uncertainty, one of the things we work on is uncertainty. And like it, the model knowing what it knows and whether it's right is like the most helpful production readiness step. I'm curious.
We have to move to rapid fire.
Last question.
All right.
Yeah. What percent of your customers would you say train their own models versus use models out of the box?
It's a great question. So we work with like, you know, more like Fortune 100 companies right now, and then a bunch of startups too. But I'd say the large enterprises, like everyone is running a like an OpenAI POV of some, or they're doing using some things, and then they're doing maybe one other closed model provider, and then they're experimenting with open source. Mm. As a side note, a lot of the spend that we're seeing, I don't think it's going to go away, but I think it's worth noting that a lot of that is innovation lab, that's demos, right? Yeah. And a lot of that is going to siphon off what we're seeing to smaller models for production. Yeah. So we're going to see some interesting trends that are maybe a little bit different than what people are projecting or predicting, because it's just a very natural dynamic. So I think most people are kind of settling into using, very few people I think are actually training their own from scratch, although we're seeing it. We have some results with one of our partners, Wayfair, around domain-specific multimodal models that is actually, you know, pre-training, not just fine-tuning. But most of what I'm seeing is just open source model with some fine tuning or alignment on top.
Interesting.
All right, we're going to move into rapid fire Q&A. We have so many more questions, but we'll contain them. For this, just a few words answer, and I'm going to actually maintain that.
What did I do in the last session that worried you about my
brevity?
Yeah,
I get the sense that this will be critical here. We're going to do that, but then also a reminder to get in your questions because we'll go right into audience Q&A after that. All right. What is one company you're bullish on besides yours, and it also can't be OpenAI?
I'm bullish on Hugging
one
Face,
to five,
open source.
You. There you go. Hugging Face, open source. Okay, great. Favorite generalist model?
I think Opus is. Deserves a lot of credit. Yeah, I think a lot of thought went into the alignment of that. Big fan of alignment, so, yeah.
RAG versus long context? both.
But long context, especially with structured state space models, is going to eat up a lot of the applications out there and all the simpler ones. I think bigger applications and production applications will be RAG just because people like building modular systems.
Elon Musk, Sam Altman, Mark Zuckerberg, who will have the biggest long-term impact on AI?
I think Mark Zuckerberg.
Wait,
really?
What about Satya Nadella? Keep going.
Next, sorry. Zuckerberg. Why?
I mean, they've been investing in. I mean, some of that's just like a loyalty part. You know,
Team open source.
Yeah, we're neutral as a vendor and a platform to closed open source. But you know what Facebook has been doing for supporting not just, you know, very legitimate research, but open model development is pretty impressive, and they've been ahead of the curve. You know, they were buying. I think this just came out where they got hammered in the markets because they went on a purchasing spree of GPUs like a year, I forget, like a while ago. I think they're ahead of the curve. I think they're going to surprise people.
Yeah, for Opus, what do you like about it?
I haven't had a chance to play around with it a lot yet. I think a lot of the research that the Anthropic team puts out around alignment specifically, which is near and dear to my heart because a lot of what we work on is super interesting and clever and high quality. So I'm guessing based on some of the research that I think is behind it that it's cool. I have had very little free time to like chat with LLMs recently.
In 5 years, will the gap between closed and open source be bigger or smaller?
Smaller, especially if weighted by actual real-world value, I think.
What is one leader in AI or elsewhere that has inspired you?
I think I'm going to sound I sound like I'm shilling Meta. I think Jan LeCun has been a powerful voice,
really?
And is like, you know, one of the. I almost went to either his lab or one of his partner's labs as a grad student. I was a big fan of him in the academic days, and now a big fan of him in the, you know, open closed source culture war days. I don't know why I'm shilling Meta all of a sudden. I really don't.
You should have just worn a Meta hat. I'm at this point.
I know. The biggest improvement you've made, like in terms of skills as a leader, from when you first were a PhD student to today.
Patience. I mean, you got to be impatient, but some of these things are slow, right? Like the effective time scale, especially in enterprise and especially with like company building and product building, and all of them combined is a little bit longer than what you get conditioned to in most of your education, if you think about it. So I think impatience you can't lose. You have to push people, but a little bit of patience and longer term thinking.
AGI, real or not? Thoughts on it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean. I mean, the definition we used to use of just, you know, one model, we used to call it, a lot of the work was in this area called multitask learning. So just the idea that the nerdy definition of like not Terminator Skynet, but just like a model that works pretty well on multiple tasks, like we're there. Mm-hmm. And then the, you know, sentience one, I don't know, I'll bow out of that question. But I mean, I think it's achievable. I don't think we're there. I think we're still a ways away. From what we define as, the full spectrum of reasoning capabilities. I don't see a reason why it's not achievable, though.
What's one assumption you got wrong when you first were building Snorkel?
Well, actually, that Google and Apple would be the right customer segment to target.
Interesting.
Come full circle. Spent a while on that before we switched directions. Not because they're not wonderful, but just again, like, you know, you want to go after. The right segment.
Not good buyers.
Yeah, that is a good buyer. Not just the one that kind of gets your messaging or your tech the best at the beginning.
Yeah. Do you use ChatGPT regularly?
I don't a lot, to be honest. I may at some point. I've got a 4-week-old at home. There's a lot going on. Last time I wrote code? Probably 6 to 9 months ago, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty recent.
I think some people would be embarrassed to admit that they hadn't written code for 6-9 months, and I think it's like a weird cultural thing. I just kind of focus on whatever the gap is that needs to be filled in the organization. And I try to fire myself from other ones, and like, you know, there's some like cultural posturing, but it's just like me writing code with my current schedule is not helpful for anyone.
No, so definitely not.
Or like not like writing any line of code, but like writing code at the company. That's like an active blocker. That's a bottleneck in the organizational structure. So
definitely. Yeah.
Speaking of your time at the company, what are the top three areas that you do allocate your time to?
Spending time with customers and prospects. So you get different signal from customers who are using your product, and then from prospective customers who aren't, even ones who might be on the path out of the pipeline, not using it. You know, that's very valuable signal and different signal. I'm spending a lot of time on the productization of a lot of the support for generative use cases. So how do we use Snorkel to do things like programmatic alignment, you know, feeding data to RLHF and DPO and KTO style algorithms, fine-tuning, tuning RAG systems, this idea of full system tuning, not just LLM tuning. Mm-hmm. So productization, by the way, doesn't, from our perspective, doesn't just mean building the product, it means...
3 to 5 words.
Okay, I'm done.
No, okay.
That was two.
That was just the one two. Thing. So and that people, was customers.
Execs, yeah.
Product, execs, like people, team, making sure your exec team flows.
Yeah, I mean, hiring and managing execs is something that, that's another learning. People things usually require a lot more time and a lot more full cycle. Like, if you're going to be hiring for, especially an executive role, anytime in the next 18 months, you should be already meeting, you know, kind of prototype candidates just to get calibrated on what great looks like, you know, probably now. So there's a lot of hours that go into that.
What is one thing you're compulsive about?
inbox and to-do list zero.
Really?
Wow. How often?
With liberal snoozing.
Okay. That's still.
Like every day?
Not today. not in the last 4 weeks. So, but yeah, when I can, you know.
We ruined your inbox and to-do list zero. Man. Best piece of advice you've ever gotten? Or worst?
Well, my dad always says most things turn out well in the end. It's a very privileged thing. I get, we all live in a very lucky place and time in the world to be able to say that. But you know, it's a lot of anxieties that you know, it, especially for anyone here who's doing a startup. You know, I know you all are perfectly cool and not at all worried. I get anxious all the time. So just for what it's worth, so just you know. Relaxing and you know, looking back, and you know, most things work out. Just kind of, you know, even if they don't work out as you want them, they work out some way. So just, you know, a little bit of zen.
You mentioned you get anxious. What's one thing you do to manage your anxiety as a CEO?
I run a lot. If you track my mileage, you.
Are you on Strava?
I'm on Runkeeper, which is like, yeah.
What?
It's but honestly, a great example of product stickiness because like, I'm like. Yeah, I get that reaction a lot when I mention it. But like, I've just used it for many, many years, and they have all my data, and I'm too lazy to move it. So great example of product stickiness. We could all aspire.
One more, Kenju?
One trend in AI you're paying close attention to?
Synthetic data, super interesting. I have a strong opinion there.
What's your strong opinion?
Which is?
Well, it's a very nerdy one. I sound like this is going to be spicy, and it's not. It's just very nerdy. But it's basically synthetic data these days is mostly just data labeling, sampling, curating out of an LLM. So, I mean, that's kind of a snorkel pitch, but it's interesting because the actual generation, which used to be what most research focused on in synthetic data or data augmentation, is actually kind of easy now. Now it's like, okay, how do I like take what came out of some LLM and like shape it so it mirrors the distribution or the population I'm trying to mirror. So something that might be able to connect the dots and guess that we're very excited about and actively supporting at Snorkel.
Nice. All right, last question. And your answer can't be Mark Zuckerberg. If you could hire anyone, dead or alive, to join your team, who would it be?
I'm pretty basic. I don't read a lot of history books. I think like you know either Oppenheimer or someone involved in that project. Just like the World War II era mentality of just you know getting stuff done. I guess you know just from a functional perspective, I think some of that urgency is very inspiring. The Skunk Works urgency, and then. A terrible period in history, but fun in terms of some of the innovation that happened in that kind of pressured situation. So, yeah.
All right, with that, round of applause for Alex. All right, we're going to move into audience Q&A. So let me get.
By the way, those got tougher at the end. This happened.
They get harder.
Yeah. I was at a dinner recently with some like investors and stuff, and there were like AI questions. And then at the end, they're like, "And here's a softball. What's a book you've read recently?" And I like froze up. I'm like, "Shit."
What are books?
That's a good
one
for
what's free time?
What is free time?
Yeah, we have some ones usually that are like favorite Twitter follow or like favorite thing you've read recently. And I was just like, 4 week old Nix. He's not on Twitter.
Very, very kind of you.
All right, so I'm going to call people's names. And then you'll be handed a microphone. Stand up, and then you'll get a microphone, and you can ask your question. Will Brackett, start us off.
Thanks, Alex. My question is, how do you see the demand for data in an LLM world evolving? And what do you think are the types of data that have consistent demand as LLMs evolve?
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think... So demand for data, I think maybe a slightly different one to start with that is like value of data. And I think the simple thing to say there is that the more private and domain specific you know, data is, the more valuable it is. So just, you know, basic supply demand. But I think, again, that's like a simple heuristic for a lot of not just data, but model and application value, right? If you're building a model that somehow is like a standard architecture, standard algorithm, and derivative of, you know, a very public data source, the moat around that, and therefore the value, is probably going to trend towards zero. So a lot of it's going to trace back to, like, you know, what data, what models built on that data, what companies and products built on those models and data traces back to something that's kind of private and domain specific. Demand for data, like there's all kinds of, like, data feeds that you know, hedge funds purchase. Maybe I'll give one other little bit on that. Like, I think a lot of the demand for data and even, you know, like labeled and curated data right now, that is a lot of it by volume is like stuff that's done by outsourced manual annotators, often in pretty poor conditions. I think a lot of that is going to subside quite a bit, because the stuff that can be produced by that can also be increasingly produced by an LLM. The stuff that, you know, an LLM like GPT-4 can't produce is heavily correlated with the stuff that lives inside kind of private domain-specific silos. So I think that's a big kind of bifurcation of the world in terms of value of data.
All right, Manav?
Hi. What advice do you have for structuring design partnerships that are win-win, especially when you're starting out as a startup?
Awesome question. So I think, first of all, there's just like the idea of doing design partnerships in general. And I think, I think even Paul Graham has an essay on this. So this is not a unique perspective in Silicon Valley anymore, I don't think. But like this idea of don't try to be too scalable too quickly. Now, that definitely pertains in the enterprise. Consumer, I'll say less there. But I think, you know, the value, especially as an early stage startup, that you can get from making a few design partners successful, both in terms of enterprise value for your startup and your startup's reputation and product learnings, is massive. So I think, you know, first of all, not saying, okay, well, we've got to be ready for 10,000 users on day one, again, especially if you're in enterprise, but rather saying, look, we're going to work with a couple design partners very closely, and we're not going to turn our noses up if there's a consulting element to it, because that's another failure mode I see. So now this is getting to your question, how to structure design partnerships. Thing number one, I wouldn't structure them too closely. Think about it this way. You're walking a knife edge between becoming a consultant and becoming and just failing the design partnership. And you can, there are failure modes on both sides, right? There are companies that are broken on both sides. I've literally had like one of our early design partners, a top three US bank, like right after we signed our initial POV, was like over beer saying how they're like, oh, we've like broken a lot of startups, right? So, you know, you can overfit to a design partner. It's a fun thing to say over a beer, right? But it was coming from a nice place. He was saying, don't say yes to us on everything, watch out. But you know, if you say yes to too many things with those design partners, you can kind of get overfit to that company, and either you become a consultant, which is a wonderful profession, but may not fit what your funding model from your venture capitalist friend, you know, supports or is meant to support you for, or just straight up you just get spread thin and die. The other direction, though, the failure mode is, you just don't, it doesn't work, and they get bored of you. And often they get bored of you, and you spend months more before you even realize that of, you know, hard work. So I think it's a much better bet to try to do the former. And most people here are technology thinkers, right? What's your job as a technologist and a product builder? It's to abstract, right? It's to take a couple data points and abstract into something more general. So I think it's a much better bet to just do the unscalable things. Don't structure the design partnerships too much. If they ask you to do something that doesn't fit into what your product scope should, great, do some solutions engineering. Enterprise companies at scale do that too. They have whole teams to do that, right? So just do whatever it takes to make them successful, and then count on your product ability to generalize. Last thing I'd say is I would charge for design partnerships. And I'd charge beyond the kind of credit card spending limit, which is like a super uncomfortable conversation. Like if you're just starting out, this is our experience, and you're like having to, with a straight face, say like, pay me $50,000, and then you're having to get rejected many, many times with a straight face, that could feel like a questionable decision. But the key is, you know, it's much more harmful to you as an early stage startup to waste 6 months on a project that no one cares about and no one ever will care about, or that people don't prioritize because no one's put money down. No one's neck is on the line for it. So you're just, you know, waiting, you know, a month at a time for someone to respond to you about data access or something like that. If you convince some design partners to actually pay, then you're on the hook, but they're on the hook too. Now, as you actually, paradoxically, as you get bigger as an enterprise company, you start relaxing this because you start trusting your sales team to actually do the diligence on, is there real budget? Is this real? And who cares about this? But when you're just a small team, there's no way that you're going to figure out, at least in the enterprise, whether you're working on something that no one cares about or everyone cares about. So the best probe for that is just charge something non-trivial.
Caden, a little bit related here.
I would like to understand a little bit more on the partnership vein of how you did get that relationship with Apple and Google off the ground, and if you would describe that as more of like a partner play versus a traditional sales deal, like you said at the beginning.
Sure. So the Apple Google stuff, which I think came from one part of our website, was most of that was research days. So that was from the Stanford and UW labs. So that was, I think, kind of just different. That was just purely research collaborations. And then that kind of, you know, spread from there. We do now currently have a partnership with Google Cloud and Azure and AWS. So that's kind of something separate. And I guess my quick 2 cents there would be, an obvious signing thing, but like you should have like very, very, like your time is your greatest asset. You know, I'm sure you heard that before, and it's super easy to get spread thin. Don't engage in a partnership with any larger entity unless you have like very clear and mutually exchanged goals of like what you want to get out of it. And what you want to get out of it often or may not be channel. So for example, for us, you know, we have co-sell and, you know, channel partnership agreements with the big cloud providers. That was a lot of last year with our head of partnerships. But our main goal was actually not that. It was to get, you know, collateral and architecture diagrams and marketplace, you know, arrangements set up so that we could sell to our customers who were building on top of those cloud platforms in a better way. Mm-hmm. It was not so much channel. We want to get there, but that wasn't just, we had to pick our battle. So be clear what your objectives are. Be really, really narrow about them. Like we're a slightly bigger startup now, and even we said, look, we can't do channel right away. We're just going to focus on like these three things, and don't assume it's channel right away.
All right, last question, Aksha.
Yeah, hi. So I wanted to ask, do you feel pressure from clients or investors or whatever to make your data annotation pipelines more rely on LLMs and like defend the cost of, you know, doing more reliable processes, which might cost more, but yeah, how do you deal with that? And yeah.
Yeah, great question. A lot of the pressure is not actually from investors. So mostly what we sell is a platform for data science teams. Pressure really comes from users or prospective users. What do they want to use? And there's a lot of alignment there right now. And I think a lot of people are kind of getting this idea that LLMs are kind of like a foundation, at least in these enterprise settings, that you have to kind of build on top of. So a lot of how we incorporate it, and I may not be perfectly answering your question, but a lot of how we incorporate it in our platform, and also just how we think people will use it in general, even in our academic work, is, you know, think of these as like the jumpstart. And so, you know, in some use cases, your out of the box LLM will label everything perfectly, but then you don't need to be labeling data to tune anything. You already have the solution. So we're working in the settings where they don't work out of the box, and there, you know, methods and approaches where they can kind of be the jump start, and then you segue from there. So we had a paper, here's a public reference, if you want to get really nerdy, about how you can start with prompting. This is at iClear last year, and there are a couple papers in this line of work, And then you can kind of transition into fine-tuning. So I think a lot of the way that we think the space should go, we build against this, but we also just talk about it, is use LLMs, use really accessible tools like prompting to kind of get started, but then have in mind this like, you know, build pathway towards production that, you know, kind of uses successively more powerful tools. That may not, a little off track there, but that just some commentary there. So LLMs for us are the starting point, and maybe they're the ending point if you're tuning them, but generally there's other stuff you have to do to fill in the gaps where they're not working, right?
All right, on that note, big round of applause for Alex. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for joining, and especially to Stitch for hosting us in their stunning office today. We have drinks. Alex will hang for a little bit, though he has to get home to his young new addition. Thank you all for joining, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you guys.